Und hier sind wir wieder, euer digitales Wassereis, die akustische Erfrischung auf dem Weg zum nächsten Badesee. Das will ich doch wohl hoffen, dass ihr genauso wie ich im Moment irgendwo am Strand liegt, ob jetzt an einem See oder am Meer, die Kopfhörer im Ohr und gemütlich die nächste Spezialfolge Du Digitale euch reinzieht. Denn wir kommen heute wieder mit einer Sonderfolge zu euch. Wir blicken erneut zurück auf den ECD. Klar, wisst ihr ja, das ist die Serie, die Sommerloch-Serie sozusagen. Und haben euch heute einen Mitschnitt eines, ja, ich würde sagen, wirklich besonderen Panels mitgebracht. Der Titel lautet Higher Price Points in a D2C Multi-Channel World. The Next Big Thing? ? Natürlich Higher Price Point. Ihr ahnt es. Es ging um das Thema Premium and Luxury in Fashion und Lifestyle. So in diesem Umfeld. Alle Teilnehmer, die ihr in den Shownotes auch sehen könnt und gleich in der Anmoderation auch hören könnt, kommen natürlich aus diesem Segment der Fashion-Welt. Und es ist ja ganz spannend, weil wir haben im Podcast ja auch schon das ein oder andere Mal drüber diskutiert, dass es so ein großer Hype war, vor allem beginnend im letzten Jahr, auch noch in diesem Jahr, dass Premium und Luxury die Marktplatzindustrie jetzt endlich auch erreicht haben und dafür Wirbel sorgen. Dann wurde wieder ein bisschen downgegradet. So erfolgreich ist es ja alles gar nicht. Und wir haben wirklich diskutiert, ja, wie ist es denn jetzt nun? Es war ja im Juni relativ aktuell. Wie ist die Realität im Marktplatzbusiness? Wie gut geht's Premium Luxury im Digitalbusiness? Und wenn nicht so gut, was kann denn getan werden, um es noch besser zu machen? Denn dass der Bedarf an den Produkten im höheren Preissegment da ist, das zeigen alle Studien, Erhebungen, Befragungen. Aber man muss es natürlich auch gut machen. Und man muss auch als Kunde wissen, wo man dann das alles findet. Das ist ja gar nicht so einfach. Darüber haben wir diskutiert. Und da waren wirklich ein paar sehr großartige Insights dabei von Moschino, von Timex, von Philipp Plein. Wirklich Leute, die da ganz vorne mitspielen in dem Bereich. Also raus aus den Krokolederschuhen, den Moschino-Gürtel abgeschnallt, Füße hoch oder ins Wasser und reinhören. Viel Spaß dabei. Bis nächste Woche.
Willkommen in der Welt von Du Digitale, in der die Zukunft des E-Commerce schon heute beginnt. Alexander Otto und Marcel Brindöpke führen durch das Labyrinth der digitalen Revolution. Von den neuesten E-Commerce-Trends bis hin zu den disruptiven Technologien, die den Markt formen. Bist du bereit?
Okay, as this is this big of a round, we start a little introduction of yourselves, maybe with a little elevator pitch. Olga, let's start with you, right? Who are you? What do you do at Philipp Plein? And what do you do when you're not at Philipp Plein?
Oh my God, I was afraid about this question. So first of all, hi, thank you for having me here. I'm head of e-commerce at Philipp Plein. Basically, I'm overviewing all of the channels, including also online marketing and marketplaces, of course. In the time when I'm not working, if the time exists, I love traveling a lot, especially now, you know, discovering Italy for me because it's so close, especially the luxury is there, you know, reading books and also learning new things.
Okay.
Especially about branding, languages, etc.
Learning is good. Always yeah. Good. Ivan, introduce yourself and as a business person and maybe as a private person also.
Well, I'm in charge of global retail and business development for Moschino. I recently moved back to Europe after living 20 years in Hong Kong. So don't be fooled. I'm actually Chinese inside, only looking Italian. I travel most of my time for business. So during my free time, I'm very boring. I don't want to move from the sofa. When I have a little bit of spare time, I like to play tennis. Italians, Yannick Sinner, number one. So
he's a big tennis player as well. Maybe we can next year. Not table tennis, real tennis outside.
Exactly. Yes. No problem.
Okay.
Right there. And a gym and books. That's it.
But that's a lot. That's a lot. Francesca, what is your role at Metis? What are you doing? And how is it as an Italian living in Spain?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. So I'm director of marketplaces at Metis. So what I do is work alongside the digital leads in helping them shape the trading, the expansion strategy for marketplaces across global markets. As an Italian in Spain, first, I don't feel alone. So, you know, there are like 800,000 Italians living in Spain. and many of them in Madrid,
yeah,
where I'm based. And there are only 100,000 Spanish living in Italy. So it's very full, it's very crowded. And same as what Ivan said, I think it's fantastic when you have a chance then to discover a country, to spend time and understanding the local culture. In Spain, same as in Italy, the food and the wine. And the wine.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's exceptional. So I really enjoy it. It's one of the best, I have to say, life-work balance that I've ever had in my life.
Wow, that's amazing. Ricardo, what's your work-life balance? And what do you do when you work and what do you do in life?
And my wife would say it's terrible, but I like to say it's not too bad. So Ricardo Martins, I'm Portuguese. Right. You guys know a lot of famous Portuguese. I'm not one of them, but thanks to them, it gets much easier to travel across Asia and the Middle East, especially when you carry suitcases with a lot of things that do TikTok inside. Right. Yes. I just want to talk about Cristiano Ronaldo and let you through. So that's the good part. It's also one of the things I do professionally, but also personally, we travel a lot. I head our digital partnerships at Timex Group. That means both the wholesale relationships with the major platforms and also marketplaces, or also work closely with the team at Matthews and Francesca. I play football lately because of my knee. I actually coach football. One thing I would tell you guys, don't really get into that. Telling a 45-year-old he doesn't know how to play football is the toughest job in the world. But, you know, it's a bit fun and at least de-stresses from the work. But coming back quickly to Timex, right? So we are a group. We have a variety of own brands and external licenses, including Philipp Plein timepieces. And this team that I have the pleasure of working with runs international partnerships from EMEA, APAC, including China.
Brilliant. Thanks for this introduction. We know now a lot more about you. That's lovely. So let's start with the real topics, right? Let's go deep into the real stuff. But before we dig deep into the secrets sort of love of luxury brands and the marketplace business, I want to know, we thought about that. We want to stay there and first of all, define the distinction between luxury and premium and what we call the normal brands out there. So guys who dress like me, right? So maybe I'll go with you because Philipp Plein is so shiny and really you look very shiny, by the way. Philipp Plein represents luxury also by a very expressionistic design. There are a lot of really exceptional examples on your website.
I mean,
so what do you make or what are you doing to make sure that you're perceived as a luxury brand? I mean, it's not just only putting expensive stuff on clothes, right? So what are your luxury ingredients from a brand equity also?
So basically, Philipp Plein, as you said, it's very particular. So it's a very bold brand. I would say it's everything opposite what luxury usually does. But in order to make the experience amazing for our clients, so it's really about the emotions and it's about the personal experience of every client. You won't believe, but if you're the client and Philipp saw you already like at one event, etc., he knows you. So he will come to you and say, hey, how are you doing? I remember last year it was so destroyed because you were divorcing. How is it now, etc.? So basically, this is something different. What we try to do, this luxury and really personal experience with our clients. Of course, online, it's a bit more complicated. But even there, we have a special team so that people feel luxury even if they shop online, you know. In general, of course, this is material. I should not even mention this because it's something that you fill with luxury immediately. And of course, the quality of the service. This is something that should be in place.
Okay.
Yeah. Francesca, you also work for brands like Pepe Jeans, for example, also Hackett, and a brand which I hope I spell right, Fashionable. Yeah. Correct. Wow. That is amazing. How did I get to that? So it's a broader variety of brands, right? So it's somewhere between premium and luxury. And how do you make sure that these brands are distinct? And how can you make sure that every brand has the image you desire?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because for instance, in the group of All We Wear, so AWWG, managing across e-com and the marketplaces within sometimes even the same distribution, the different positioning is really the exercise that Olga was mentioning into bringing that emotion to the customer. So what would define luxury from premium is, of course, the brand value, what I'm sending as a message as a brand, the exclusivity, that is in the curated assortment, that is in the distribution. And then, of course, all of that builds the price-quality ratio. If you think of Pepe, what is fundamental across all of the sales channels is really bring that aspirational. The brand needs to be recognizable. It needs to be out there. The customer needs to understand the functionality of a denim from Pepe Jeans. And it needs to naturally associate certain images, emotions with what the brand stands for. And the digital sales channels can really do that by engaging, of course, with assets, with marketing, with social media. So for instance, when I think of Pepe, like I think of Lila Moss going on a Saturday afternoon in London with a sweat and some baggy denim, that's an image you directly recognize with denim, with Pepe. The moment you have that clear, it's fairly then easier to, and you share it, of course, with the rest of the stakeholders in Zalando or in the other marketplaces, then it becomes easy to transmit the message. The exercise, of course, is different on Naked and Fashionable. They are not yet luxury, but what we're doing in the selling exercise is more of a towards luxury aspirational selling proposition. So the craftsmanship, we talk about the textile, we talk about where the fabrics come from, the exclusivity. So we want the customer to think, if I'm buying fine wool suit from Hackett, I'm in Savile Row shopping in London. It's that then translated into the environment. So that's why what we do across the team is really to visualize what is my identity, what I want to transmit, and whether all the assets and all the communication that we produce needs to be coherent with this message.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And Ivan, I mean, when you have a look at Moschino, we have a lot of it pieces and you are very loud by presenting the brand on most of your products, right? So is it a symbol of luxury brands that the customers are proud ambassadors of the brand? And is that one of the reasons why you are so bold with the brand on so many of your pieces?
Well, there is a fashion show in 2 days. I'm not sure we're going to be so bold. I would say we're ironic. Let's put it this way. But I think when your customer become your brand ambassador for a brand that is so visual, like our brand, it's actually the best advertising possible. I mean, you reach the goal, basically. You can have different kind of collaboration with brand ambassador, with KOL, with KOC, whatever you want to call them. The top celeb, they basically serve an awareness purpose. Then you have an activation engagement purpose when you go into the core. But eventually, when you talk about real conversion, who can influence and actually activate, stimulate a real purchase is your peer. So the brand ambassador, your customer, the KOC as we call them. And true, when you are so visual as Moschino, the games becomes a bit easier because if someone wearing Moschino enters the room, you might most likely notice this person. Meantime, other brands, so-called quiet luxury, is something that comes slightly slower. So from this perspective, the identity of Moschino helps to make our brand ambassador highly recognizable.
Yeah.
You don't wear your Moschino belt today, by the way.
Not this day, maybe tonight.
Like always, on the dance floor. Ricardo, Timex is a watchmaker company, right?
And 70-year-old.
And you have your own brands, but you also do produce for other iconic brands such as Ferragamo, Versace, or as we heard, Philippe Lyon. Tell us how it is to produce for these brands and their own brand image, and how stressful is it to meet their demands, or is it not stressful at all?
She's already laughing.
I think it depends, right?
So what's your answer?
With Lyon is of course very easy. You know, it's the best relationship we have, as you can imagine, right? But maybe coming to also some of the things you talk about, you know, luxury and delivering experience and delivering consistent message around brands. Ultimately, you know, as a licensee, we have a responsibility to be a gatekeeper of what these brands stand for. So fundamentally, I think that's a driving principle for the group, right? We've been in licensing business for about 40 years. And we work very close with our licensors, with our partners at every stage of what is a very verticalized operation, right? We design, we manufacture, we retail, we do customer care as well. in a multitude of channels, a rather complex distribution. So of course, they're challenges. But I would say that fundamentally, you know, delivering that experience and delivering that message that the Maison, the house brand, stands for becomes very critical for us.
Mm.
And we do that, of course, through product. We do that through campaigns, through assets, but we also do that in the way we operate, for example, marketplaces or direct to consumer, which is a lot more challenging, right?
Yeah.
And I guess we'll talk about that later. But, you know, it really varies. But at the end of the day, I would say, you know, we are in this together, right? We are in this to talk to the consumers that we think have an affinity towards the brand. And I think the watches somehow have an advantage that we tend to have, and I could be wrong here, right? Compared to perhaps more the ready-to-wear or more the fashion side of the business, people tend to have a very strong emotional connection with watches. You know, we make timepieces from 50 euros to 50,000 euros.
Mm.
And sometimes we have people that, you know, say, can you repair my watch? You know, I know it was only 100 euros. I know it's 35 years old, but it's really important to me, right? I think that's probably something that you do not see in many industries. And I think we're a bit privileged to be able to keep these really strong emotional connections with people, right? That was my first watch. That was from my grandmother. That was from, you know, a special occasion for me. I think people have a tremendous emotional connection with their timepieces. And we're a bit privileged to work with some great brands. You know, some are a headache. I can't say names.
not here today.
But, you know, but those headaches also help us to learn. They help us to become better. They help us to, you know, go to our consumers with a better product very often, right? And a better message and a better way of delivering the full package.
Ricardo, thanks. I will take that to the audience for a moment, because I want to know who of you wears his 50,000 euro watch today. Marina.
What is the question?
Where's your 50,000 euro watch?
I forgot it.
You forgot it.
Yeah.
What was the last luxury item you bought?
I forgot.
You forgot. Okay. You forgot. What about you?
Okay. I am a bit biased because I do wear a Ferragamo watch.
Ha. There you go.
Yes. And it was a gift.
And so you love it and you will love it in 20 years.
Yeah. This is a classic. So definitely.
Exactly what you said. You were kind of connected.
Somehow.
Okay. Serge, where's your 50,000 euro watch?
I was rather hoping there'd be one in a fortune cookie.
Oh, a 50,000 euro watch in a fortune?
No, I don't know.
We have to talk about it for next year.
Maybe for next year.
Where for next year? Okay. So, one more. Sebastian, it's you. What was... I know that one. What was the last premium luxury item you purchased?
I think it was a Hugo Boss fashion item.
Where's Thorsten? Wait here, Hugo Boss. Is that premium or is that luxury?
Premium luxury.
Okay. Thank you.
Somewhere between. Yeah, but I think it's giving good.
Plenty of customers, basically. No one has a 50,000 euro watch here.
Not yet.
Keeping an eye.
It's closing. So have it in the safe because you don't wear this. Also, yeah, I mean, while we have defined now what luxury and premium is, let's dig a bit deeper on why this gets more and more interesting for consumers. And what I notice is that with young consumers, you see a trend that you're either going to buy on Shein or Temu, or as I like to call it, Shemu, or in the higher priced areas. And this is true not only for fashion, but for other areas as well. So Francesca, do you see this effect too? And how do you respond to that in trend to approach your customers, because you have possibly also young people and want to keep them away from the Shemu area and attract them to your area?
Yeah. And it's really one of the main topics that we are facing in the past 2 years, and probably something that is really going to come with us for the following months. What we're seeing is indeed this polarization of spending. It affects young consumers, but not only, because then eventually the young consumers are more and more becoming a little bit older. They gain purchasing power. So the question that we're having is, how do we treat them? Because somehow Shein or Temu represent a version of social commerce. It is not only for the product itself. It is not only for the price that I'm paying, but it is really for that ability to move from a purely transactional, inspirational and transactional to a almost fully inspirational. So they set somehow the base and then challenge the rest of the retailers in thinking, how do I then change my game in order to adapt to that? And this is really the interesting part that then we're seeing today. And as a brand, how do you manage that? So we need, and that's what we're trying really to do today, trying to understand how to approach social commerce in general. We need to build that experience. We need to build that community in every touch point that the consumer would have across the different brands. That storytelling needs to be enriched. We need to have a connection, whether it's on the sports, whether it's on the denim lover, whether it's on occasion wear, whether it is about the sustainability talk. So it is not only the value proposition that the product holds, but it is how we get there. David before was saying, like, you know, 70% of the journey is actually the inspirational part. And that is what brand today really are doing an exercise in modeling. And going back to where Ricardo said, now, what is a bit more challenging is that as a brand or as a representative of the brand, you have the scope, you have the responsibility to protect the brand and what it stands for. And now instead, we're moving into our user-generated content, into a customization of the experience. So it is important to find that correct commercial balance about how much I can let go and how much I still need to manage within the brand boundaries.
Yeah.
So we'll see how this is going to move going forward.
So, but possibly no gamification while having a Wheel of Fortune on your app, I hope at least. Ivan, when we have a deeper look into the shoppers, what we see is that we have pure luxury shoppers, right? Who just beneath Lamborghini, they would never drive a car in their life. Then you have these aspirational shoppers, right? Like Sebastian, say, who had a Boss fashion piece and who will more or less once and then, once and now buy a luxury piece. And brands like Moschino, for example, we have a sub-brand, Love Moschino, which is possibly addressing more to the aspirational shoppers. Is this also something you do to, let's say, drag people into your brand world and maybe transform them one day to Moschino customers? Or what is the idea behind, let's say, several brand types within the portfolio?
I think it definitely is a question of journey. There are several touch points of the Maison. And let's make an example. Early 20s. Lea Girl enters in touch through social media with our Love Moschino and starts entering the universe of the Maison, right? That, again, as an expert, we like to think about first line, second line. Actually, if you make a survey, you will realize that people don't really notice this. In one of my previous experience in LVMH, I remember when they canceled like Marc by Marc. And then eventually they asked their customer, like, but did you know there was Marc Jacobs and Marc by Marc? And they were like, no. Mm-hmm. So, okay, great. So before making a move, actually start to think with the eyes of the consumer. Maybe you're going to make a more meaningful move. Going back to the Love Moschino, Moschino Couture. So enters Love Moschino and she buys a bag, let's say for party purpose, right? It's not a matter, it cannot be a matter of financial capability of purchasing the first line. It's just a path through the Maison that leads you from touch point number one to touch point number two and develop the fan, I don't like to call customer, the fan, the friend of the brand, through the different line of the Maison. Obviously, it's key to keep value and proposition consistent to build a journey so that this fan of the brand doesn't feel fragmentation or anything that is in any way awkward. And this helps you really to foster, nourish someone through the years in a one-to-one relationship through different lines of the Maison.
I see. That's very interesting. And I think what Francesca also said is that it is important how the messaging is, Ricardo, about the brand and how you address the customer and what the brand promise even is. And would you say that D2C is becoming more and more important to the brands you sell? Now that we have a lot of luxury retailers who are in trouble, when we speak about Farfetch or KaDeWe or others, Is D2C becoming more and more important for luxury brands? Or how do you see the, let's say, sales and distribution policy?
I mean, I'm not sure if it's becoming more important or is simply becoming more mature, right? And I think, you know, if I think back even of our journey at Timex Group, right, in early 2010 or something, we're trying to build skills to deal with companies like Zalando, for example, where we had just a wholesale relationship. But we knew there was a completely new set of KPIs and was clearly a new level of exposure for our brands that we are not seeing in a brick and mortar store.
Yes.
You know, you move 15 years later and realistically, we still have more people today working in store merchandising, offline store merchandising than we have working on digital visual merchandising, right? And when I talk, for example, about a DTC, be it a multi-channel or be it a direct-to-consumer, fundamentally what you know is that you have a level of scale that you are not going to see in a store, even if you are in Oxford Street or wherever it is, right? And I think it's very important that we look at the aspect of protecting brand equity and protecting the message as well, but we also focus very clearly, and I think that's one of the critical advantages of the DTC multi-channels in value creation. Right. And of course, our CFOs all like to think about value creation as, you know, higher margins, higher EBITDA, probably higher price points, everything, but also connecting a little bit to what Ivan was saying, that value creation is also about, you know, how do you create a meaningful relationship with those consumers? And, you know, you don't want to be doing that on pricing, right? That's not a meaningful relationship. That's a tactical, emotional, impulse decision, you know, and I know we're talking about that as well. Clearly, we also have to stay price competitive, but fundamentally, you want to be delivering an experience that people are going to enjoy and they believe has value to them. If they don't feel that, you also have another big problem for e-commerce, which is returns, right? You receive the product, there's a regret. And you automatically are going to return. So ultimately, you have a cost, you have everything, and you may have lost a customer, which is even the highest cost and probably the one we talk the least about, right? Mm-hmm. Always talk about direct impact of a return. To me, the real concern is, why is this consumer returning, right? If, you know, Zalando said, buy 5 shoes, we expect to deliver 4, brilliant, right? If the consumer bought 1, because he believed will deliver something that we then disappoint, then I have a problem, right? And that's not a financial problem. I have a problem with not delivering the experience I was promising my consumers. DTC allows us to obviously reinforce these. We can talk about, you know, social influencers as well, which can be very scary to Francesca's point, right? We have a couple of our influencers we have worked with in China. And they will bring 2 million people to a 20-minute event, right? If these guys not really delivering the messages I would like him to deliver, and by the way, not that he really has to, financially, you know, influencing levels, everything else is very independent. Of course, I could be just all of a sudden to one of the biggest crowds in the world promoting something that is contrary to my positioning, my values, the experience I want to deliver. So great, great space to create value to businesses. I think in that value, we really have to talk about the value of a consumer, not really financial value.
Mm-hmm. And speaking about people in China, Olga, luxury brands mostly are successful all over the globe, maybe even due to the brand promise you do and the brand's value, while many, let's say, normal brands stay local in a way. So, and therefore you have also knowledge about the world. Is D2C something which you see emerging in many markets in the world, or is it like a German-European phenomenon?
I think D2C in general is very important, especially let's talk about luxury brand. I mean, not even only luxury, but for every brand, yeah? Because like you said before, first of all, it's the brand message and you need to deliver it already in the package. So it starts with, you know, with the unpacking. Then, of course, it's the customer. You want to know who is buying you, why people return. And if they return, so you have the opportunity to call them and to ask them about it. If you talk about the global scale, it's I think if you want to extend your business, it depends, of course, on your strategy, what you want to do. but you always still should be local. Like everyone wants to go, yeah, okay, I'm going now to China. But is the Chinese consumer the same as your European consumer? So I need to say, for example, at Philip Lyon, we have wide range. So our strongest markets are completely different. So it's not like top three is one is US, one is Germany, and one is Eastern Europe. Then you have China as the next one, so it's completely different. You can say, okay, I tailor everything now on Europe because in Europe the values are pretty similar, even if they are not the same. But I do something specific in US. No, you need to do completely different stories everywhere. And talking about the China, as Ricardo mentioned before, it's really very KOL, depending how the brand is going. So you really need to be sure that you have a good partnership there. And yes, in 20 minutes, you can get so much traffic, you can get so much sales. But if there is something wrong, then you're just dead forever, especially in China. So we know all of the stories, there was different brands, I would not mention them, saying one wrong word or delivering one wrong product. I mean, so the plan is also not exception to say. So this is something that you need to know whenever you act directly. Right. Because also if you enter a partnership, it's also not, a guarantee for you that everything will go smooth whenever you are in every local. So you need to know your customer, you need to know what you are doing, you need to know where you are doing, and you need to tailor it a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's stay there for a while. We're talking about distribution models, right? So be it directly through an influencer or marketplaces. We know that luxury brands are in particular are very cautious about where to play, where to sell. It has to fit, right? So Ivan, for example, Moschino is live on a couple of marketplaces, such as Zalando as well. So what's the reason behind which one you choose? So why do you choose Zalando? Why do you choose others? And why don't you choose some? You don't have to mention them, but I don't know. So what's the factor here?
I think at the beginning was purely something casual, nobody knew what was a marketplace. It's like, let's try it, let's see what happened. And I think nobody even understood the logic of a real marketplace. Now, as we speak, with my colleague here heading the department that is watching from the standing, we are creating a matrix basically to understand where, why, what, how. What are we going to position where and why we're going to position that in that marketplace. Obviously, we are analyzing all the criteria, all the KPI, profiling of the customer, age, average transaction, geographic cover, because we would like to build something that sits and falls between the DOS strategy. And with DOS, I talk about all the premises of the brand. And premises can be digital premises, can be physical premises. And our fan shouldn't feel any kind of difference through the journey. Mm-hmm. So now the point is, which marketplace will work with Moschino through this project? The marketplace that will understand that our final goal is not money, but is equity. And when I say equity, equity represents money. So, and who is at the center of the project? The final consumer, our fan. So we have to understand and we have to recognize the right partner, create the right matrix, and allocate the right product, the right line, and the right place. Did I answer?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I get so many best answers today. I understand so much more than before. This is brilliant. Thank you for that.
It is. And Olga, I mean, with your brand as a luxury brand, you have retailers and these retailers go to marketplaces like Amazon, for example. How do you see this development and what is your strategy in brackets to stop it? Because I'm pretty sure you're not the biggest fan of this development.
Yeah, basically, this is one of the main points why also brands started at that time with the marketplaces, because you have so many wholesale partners that, of course, they also try to extend their business to get more value for what do they buy, and they extend the channels. And this is something where you see that, okay, maybe your brand presentation is not as you wish. Maybe the prices are, whenever you do wholesale or retail business, you really depend also on the partner and vice versa. Yeah. And this is what we are doing. So I need to say that the main reason why we went on Farfetch is just to control the prices. Because, we all know the story when they started connecting the boutiques, everyone has sometimes the same product, sometimes not. Then they do, I don't know, discount on one size. And then the customer is calling the brand asking, hey, can I get the same price? Because I see there was 50% discount on this size, but I want to get another one. And then you have so much churn and your brand is getting, you know, destroyed. And I think it's also one of the biggest maybe challenges, how to stay exclusive, but still being accessible for your fans. Like, because yeah, people move through the different channels. But coming back to your concrete questions, how do we deal with it? First of all, we identify who is able to sell us, who not. If we started working with our partners in a bit different way. So whenever they purchase something from us, we share with them already the list, like, okay, this is the seasonal product. So we would love to start discounting it maybe at this time. And if then this is the range, please don't go further. Of course, you can't dictate it. I mean, we all know it. But still, at least as a partnership, you can decide. Still, of course, they do their CRM activities so as we do. This is something completely different, but at least to have a bit more of the control of your brand appearance, of your brand value, and of your brand, I would say, of the even the journey. So the client doesn't call you and say, hey, I see everywhere, so can I get it? This is the important point of the marketplaces. This is the way where you should be in order at least to control it.
Okay. Francesca, you mentioned also PP Jeans. We'll come back to PP Jeans. This is a brand rather for normal people like Marcel and myself. I would think, is it okay? Is it PP Jeans or?
No, G-Star.
It's probably the same, right? Same price range in a way.
It's at least the jeans with my size.
The only one. So it's rather premium, not luxury. Would you call it? Premium is right. You call it, right? And it would interest me, how would you see the shift between wholesale and D2C? I mean, this PP is still in stores, PP is still online. So what was kind of the share also of it? So where does it go? And does that mean luxury goes there too? Because you have a working model that you can adapt.
Yeah. And so you're right, Alex. What has happened in the past years has been a transition. And somehow for some brands like PP, also a combination of insights in order to make sure that both channels were growing in the correct way without forgetting the brand equity. It has done a lot, the organization of the brand. So in the case of PP, there is a lot of focus on the market rather than what channel going to use to penetrate the market. So I start from the idea of what is the positioning that I want to achieve there? What is the type of brand mix I want to compete? And then the result would be, what is the channel? Should I be there as wholesale or should I be there as marketplace? What insights, top line insights, I'm getting on one and the other so that I can think of one strategy. It is not always the case. Very often across most of the brands, the division is always between wholesale and marketplace and e-com. So what has happened, and probably this is also one of the reasons why luxury is a bit slower into getting there, is that when partner program or marketplace has been really eating part of that business of wholesale, so creating internal tension or just that, like an overall need for an understanding of what is the strategy, and marketplace has the ability to grow much faster because you have leverage on, apart from prices, on assortments, on marketing, it is more rapid. It is very, very efficient. Now, will it happen to luxury? Somehow, and Olga was saying it, it is already there. So luxury does have wholesale. The presentation on the marketplaces is very often there. It is a question of, are the luxury brands ready to change the control and change the management? And they are getting there. We also need to make it simpler for the luxury brands to understand the different profitability or the different revenues development that you can have from the two different channels and get into that journey. But it is something that is happening. And indeed, we see the development of 24S. It's really establishing itself as the luxury, really the exclusive platform that you would have globally. Pruninger itself, or Pruninger is purely like one of the few ones that has a capability to trade up from premium to luxury. Zalando itself, and even an off-price best secret, like still keeps that exclusivity. And there are more and more which are coming, of course, around Europe and outside. So it is a journey. But what is important is really to understand which in each brand are the blockers and how they can be strategically overcome.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Another great answer.
And it's a great moving to my next question, Ricardo. I mean, marketplace is dominated by pricing, flexible pricing. People need to get the buy box in several marketplaces. And even if you don't do that, there are campaigns on the marketplaces where they want to attract customers. So isn't that kind of a no-go for a luxury brand to go on marketplaces? Because if you don't do it, how can you be successful or how can you avoid being drawn into this kind of policy?
I think there are probably two answers to that, right? One would be the ideal answer from a brand keeper. And I would say, yes, it's a no-go, right? Certainly in certain price points. But I think ultimately, you know, it's something that we are all in together, right? Including the marketplaces as well. We talked earlier on about, you know, pleasing the CFO, and clearly a non-gated marketplace that is looking to get as many commissions from as many sellers as possible is ultimately a marketplace that is generating short-term financial gain and probably long-term value destruction. Okay. And maybe talk a little bit to what Ivan was saying earlier on. I think when we're looking at our matrix and, you know, and Afiz is sitting in the crowd, right? He knows we've been a bit crazy. We're pushing our marketplace rollout agenda extremely aggressively, but in a sense that as a group, as we say, we have very different price points. So this doesn't mean we want to be in every single marketplace with every single brand. It means there are marketplaces that we are prioritizing because we believe they are partners in value creation. I'm not sure how many marketplace people are in the room. I've seen a few already around today, and I'll be talking to some of you as well. But to me, from a brand perspective, but also from someone that's also a consumer, right? I will buy commodities off Amazon. I will not buy anything that I expect to offer me an emotional experience off Amazon, be it cheaper, be it more expensive, right? Do we need to keep an eye on buy box? Of course. Do we need to stay competitive? Of course. But fundamentally, we may not want to be in certain marketplaces if we believe they are not allowing us to talk with our consumers in a way that is going to deliver the full and the true brand experience.
Yeah, I see. Alex, maybe we should with a look at the time.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, we could talk for hours and hours. This is so interesting. My brain starts learning and learning every answer you're giving. Maybe a little wrap up, a little final round. So we have to come to an end, right?
Final round, wrap up. Maybe just see what we can learn and maybe find a synthesis of what we heard today. Is D2C and marketplaces like the next big thing for luxury and premium brands? Or will it be a tightening of your relations with the wholesalers, and will you see them emerge again? And will this more or less, will D2C be a niche in a wholesale-dominated market? What would you say?
So, one sentence.
What, one sentence? Every one of you. Ricardo can start, so we can go, and Alex can finish this.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
I sort of answered that, right? It's not a new thing. I think it's something that is going to get bigger, and I think we all need to be better at managing it, right? Because fundamentally, we need our channels to be complementary and all at the service, bringing, you know, the best possible product to our consumers or to our fans, which is a concept I really like, Ivan as well. You know, I think a lot is gonna be happening in the next few years. I think some of the guys in the room will not survive. Some of us will not survive either. But I think this is a very exciting time, right? And it's great to be at events like these. And you guys had a problem today. I think you had questions that in itself were probably panels, right? That's probably why we're talking a bit too much, because it's clearly a very complex space.
But it's maybe always, we just tackled other topics we can talk about. So no worries.
I totally agree with Ricardo that for sure it has always been a topic, especially for luxury brands. Maybe just before there were stores where the luxury brands tried even from their own website to bring traffic to the store in order to give their experience, etc. Now we're just shifting because the generations are shifting. Our focus, pandemic changed also a lot. So I think this is very important and it will be bigger. The point is only we all, I think it's for every company. That's also something Francesca mentioned. Everyone is thinking like in competition within one company, but we all work for the same, for the brand, for the company, for the marketplace. So it doesn't matter where, let's say stupid like that, where the money comes from. Is it right pocket or left pocket? Is it our wholesale? Is it our direct business? So this fight for the buy box, I don't care if my partner, so if it's, let's talk Timex. Yeah. For example, if Timex does the also direct sales on any marketplace, I don't care if you sell it or I sell it, because I know that if you're successful together, we do another partnership, or my wholesale partner will buy more from us, which is also additional revenue. So I think for every brand, the main focus should be is first of all to make the consumer or the fan or the client happy, and also the partner. Otherwise, you don't need any partnership.
That was one long sentence.
Sorry.
But a very peaceful message.
A very good message.
Marketplace are here to stay. Which one, I don't know. Someone will disappear. I agree. Financial feasibility is not there. Someone will disappear because brand won't work with them anymore because they are too financially oriented for destroying equities. Mm. But they are part of the game. Players, a marketplace is like a store. It's like a shopping mall. It's just digital. It should be about experience, quality, not just financial. I buy it because it's cheaper. So marketplace have to move into this kind of direction. I like to think that a marketplace is like a store, right? But if you take away the product from the store, what you're left with, four walls and a ceiling.
Yeah.
That's it.
No, completely agree on everything that has been said. So it is, yes. So it is definitely transitioning. But marketplaces need to make it comfortable for luxury brands to be there, whether it's about branding, whether it's about in assortment, tone of voice, marketing, everything. Somehow that value proposition needs to adapt. And not every marketplace probably is going to be able to do that to the luxury environment and the brands.
I think this sent out a clear message as well. Yeah. And, thank you so much for the time you shared with us. It was very insightful, and give those four wonderful people a big round of applause. Thank you so much.
Und damit schließen wir ein weiteres Kapitel der unendlichen Geschichte des digitalen Handels. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Hast du Anregungen oder Themen für zukünftige Folgen? Melde dich gerne bei uns. Bleib neugierig und informiert. Sende uns eine Nachricht an duo@tradebyte.com.